Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm John Boland, president of KQED Public Media here in San Francisco Bay Area, and your moderator for today's program. Our guest is Kai Rizdahl, marking 10 years as the host and senior editor of American Public Media's Marketplace, the most widely heard program about business and the economy on any broadcasting platform in the United States. Here in San Francisco and Silicon Valley, Marketplace is heard on KQED Public Radio, which is where Kai actually began his radio career back in 1997. But he had a couple of careers before broadcasting. Kai graduated from Emory University in Georgetown. He spent 8 years in the United States Navy, flying from the aircraft carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt, and went on to work at the Pentagon with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He also served in the United States Foreign Service with postings to Canada and China, and then settled in California, where he now lives with his wife and 4 children. Since his start as a 34-year-old intern at KQED, Kai has become one of the most recognizable and trusted voices on the radio. He's an insightful journalist and covers business and the economy, highlighting the human stories behind the numbers. His storytelling skills, good old common sense questions, and great sense of humor attract millions of listeners to the program. Kai regularly interviews guests ranging from CEOs to entrepreneurial small business owners, and every now and then, the President of the United States. Regardless of the subject, he asks tough questions, always keeping humanity at the center of the economic story. And his signature marketplace delivery reassures us that no matter how crazy things get on Wall Street and across the global economy, we can talk through it, separate the facts from the hype, and always stay cool. We're delighted to welcome Kai Rizdahl back to San Francisco.
Well, thank you, man.
So, Kai, I want to start actually not with your radio career, okay, but with sort of your pre-radio career.
Yeah.
You lived in Europe, yep, for part of your growing up, and then you were a fighter pilot.
Well, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. I flew E-2 Sea Hawkeyes, which is a surveillance plane.
Right.
Anyway, we all wanted to be fighter pilots, believe me.
And then you were in the Foreign Service.
Yes.
All of which sounds incredibly glamorous, and things we all would imagine ourselves doing in a short story or a novel. How did you end up on that trajectory, and sort of how did you end up flying and then transition to the Foreign Service, and we'll get to radio after that?
I went to college thinking I was going to be a lawyer, and that didn't work out for a whole bunch of reasons. And I had a fraternity brother who was a year ahead of me, who had, when he graduated, gone down to Pensacola and done officer candidate school, which if you've ever seen Officer and Gentleman, Richard Gere and Deborah Winger, that whole deal, that's actually the way it goes, minus the Deborah Winger part. And I thought to myself, once I decided I didn't want to go to law school, I said, well, listen, this, you know, learn how to fly feels like a cool thing to do. And so 2 weeks after I graduated, in late May, early June of 1985, I threw everything I owned in the backseat of my car, a blue convertible 1971 Cutlass 442, which I sold for some reason, and I drove down to Pensacola, and I did 14 weeks of officer candidate school. Learned how to fly, saw the world, did 3 years at the Pentagon, as John, I think, mentioned, on the joint staff. And by that time, I was 8 years in, and I had done everything that I had joined the Navy to do, right? I'd gone to graduate school. I'd done the whole smash. But I wanted to keep going overseas on the government's dime, because why not, right? And I took and passed the Foreign Service exam to join the Foreign Service in the State Department. I separated from the Navy on a Friday in March of 1993, and the following Monday, I started in my Foreign Service orientation class. Did that for 9 weeks. Spent 2 years in Ottawa, Canada, lovely town, not terribly foreign, about as cold as I have ever been in my entire life. And then 2 years in Beijing, where my wife and I had, or my then fiance and I had been posted. We spent 6 months in language training before we went. There were four students and a native Chinese speaker in a room about half the size of this podium, 7.5 hours a day speaking Chinese. And then we did 2 years in China and came back to the States in the spring of 97.
And so after these really interesting experiences, how did you find yourself working at a bookstore in Palo Alto in 1997?
So Steph, my wife, wanted to go to graduate school. She wanted to go to business school. And this is why we're still in China. And I didn't want to do government service anymore, right? By that time, it had been 12 years, and it was time for me to do something else. She got into the business school at Stanford. She's the brains in the family. And I said, well, you know, it's 97. There's this dot-com thing going on, and I'm going to get a job in Silicon Valley. So we got here. Steph started, this is the summer of 97, Steph started some math preparation courses to, you know, to sort of refresh herself for her MBA program. And I figured I had to help pay the rent while I figured out what I wanted to do with my life. And so I got a job at the Borders Bookstore on University Avenue in Palo Alto, which I learned yesterday for the first time is now an Apple Store. Hello? What the heck, man? And that was great old theater, right? And I can't even imagine what Apple's done to it. $7 an hour, which covered, you know, basically the rent, working full time. But what happened was that I was in a really bad, dark place because I was 34 years old, had just quit a completely steady job, freshly married, about to have a baby, and I had no idea what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I moped around for most of that summer of 97. And I was objectively probably not really pleasant to be around. And one day, after 2 months of this, Steph sat me down and said, you need to get your head out of your and what I think you ought to do is you ought to try journalism because you are this weird news freak. You get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to read the New York Times. You are always trying to figure out what's going on in the world. You're crazy interested in the news. Give it a shot. And basically, I blew her off. I said, all right, fine, yeah, honey, thanks, whatever. And went on about my not-so-merry way. And then, like 10 days, 2 weeks later, I was in the bookstore. And when you work at a bookstore, what you have to do at closing time is you have to go around and pick up all the books that all the customers leave while they're browsing and you know, getting ready to figure out what they want to buy. And you have to reshelve. You have to put them back on the shelves. And I was doing this one night at quitting time. It was like 11:15 at night. And I'm hauling around this cart full of books, and I reach for the next book, and I'm in the career and counseling section, and it's one of those really thick books that lists every internship in the world, you know, whatever it is. And so I start flipping through, and I find the name and the address of the guy who was then the senior news editor at KQED. His name is Cyrus Musiker.
And he's still there.
I know. And I went home, and I wrote him an honest to God letter, like with pen and paper, you know, none of this email stuff. And I said, "Dear Mr. Musiker, I have no background in journalism, but I'm extremely interested in the news. I'm well educated, broadly experienced, well traveled. Could we please talk?" 2 or 3 days later, the phone rings, and he says, "Why don't you come on up and we'll have a chat." So the next day, I got on the train from Menlo Park, put on a spiffy little suit and a tie, you know, fresh from the State Department, right? I mean, you wore a suit and a tie to work every day. Had a little briefcase, and got on the train from Menlo Park and came up to the city, and I walked into the KQED newsroom. And first of all, anybody who's been in a public radio newsroom knows that you don't wear a suit and a tie and carry a spiffy little briefcase in a public radio newsroom. So everybody kind of looked at me funny, and I said, "Hi, I'm here to see Cyrus Musiker." Cy and I sat down and chatted for a while, and at the end of it, he said, "Listen, I can't obviously offer you a job, but what if you cut back your hours at the bookstore, come on up here and intern for us 2 days a week, and we'll teach you how to do radio?" And I said, "Sure." So I cut back my Tuesday and Thursday hours at the bookstore, and the following Tuesday, and this was then January of 98, beginning of January, I went up into the second floor conference room at KQED, sat down at a conference room table with Cyrus and 5 other interns. They were 19 years old. I was 35, 34, and they taught me everything. They taught me how to hold a microphone, how to listen for sound, how to write for voice, how to cut tape on what was then literally tape. It was quarter-inch reel-to-reel with a grease pencil and splicing tape and razor blades. And that's how I wound up at KQED. I mean, there's more, but...
And over the course of that time, I think by the time you left, I don't think you still had, like, a regular job, but you were...
No, I never got hired at KQED. What happened was No, I never did. They never actually hired me, and it took them... Cyrus denies this, but it took them, like, a year and a half to actually put me on the air. What happened was, after this, you know, 90-day internship or whatever it was, Cyrus came to me and he said, listen, could you come at 4:30 in the morning and help produce the morning news with Kathy Barron, who's no longer there, but Kathy was the morning news anchor. And I said, of course, yeah, absolutely. So I did that for a couple of months. Then I started producing some afternoon stuff. And then like a year, 14 months later, they finally put me on the air reporting my own stories. And then about a year and a half in, it wasn't Cyrus. Cyrus had moved on by then, but I think it was David Gorn, who was then the news editor, called me at home at 9 o'clock at night, and he said, Kathy is sick. Can you do the morning news tomorrow? No, can you do, it was Kevin Guillory. Can you do the afternoon news tomorrow afternoon? And I said, sure. And I walked in the next morning and I started asking people how you do the afternoon news. I mean, what the hell did I know, right? Because there's timing and there's all kinds of stuff. That worked out all right. Then I did the morning news and then I did the California Report for a while, filling in for Scott Schaefer on the statewide show. And then about 2.5 years into my time at KQED, somebody at Marketplace, a guy by the name of J.J. Yore, who was then the executive producer, heard me and called me and said, listen, we've got this morning report job. Why don't you come down and talk to us? And that was 14 years ago this spring.
And I think one of the things that you did at KQED in your non-job was to substitute host on the California Report as well, which really gave you that hosting experience. So the Marketplace Morning Report, that must be an early rising.
So it goes on the air at 2:50 in the morning L.A. time, and this is back when it was based in L.A., right? It's now based in New York with a guy by the name of David Brancaccio, who I'm sure many of you know. So David gets to get up a little later. But when I was doing the show, it was based in L.A. I got out of bed at midnight, went on the air at 2:50 in the morning, did hourly shows until 6:50, I guess. And then I went for a run for an hour. I came back and I worked on a show that was then called Marketplace Money. I went home at noon. I slept 12:30 to 3:30 in the afternoon, got the kids out of daycare, did the homework and you know, making dinner thing, had about an hour with my wife, and then I slept 9 to midnight. Did that for 4 years.
4 years, yeah. Wow. Yeah. So I'm sure it was a real pleasure when you got promoted to the regular show.
It was really nice to get a day job. It was nice to get the big show. But what the interesting thing is, I actually have less time with my kids now that I've got a day side job than I did when I was working the overnights, right? I mean, you know, because I was there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Because you didn't have that break in there. So interesting. It made it more complicated with the morning report being on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And obviously Marketplace was around for 15 years before you became the primary host. Why is it on the West Coast? Because everything has to be timed to the markets in the East Coast.
So the short answer is that that's where the money was. When Marketplace was started in 1989, the only place where we could get real seed money and facilities was a station called KLON in Long Beach, California. We were in a storefront in Long Beach. It was Jim Russell, J.J. Yore, and a guy by the name of John Barth, who started Marketplace. It was a shoestring operation at best. Those three guys will tell you stories of being within days of missing payroll and having to shut the whole enterprise down. We eventually were purchased and funded by KUSC and the University of Southern California. We were headquartered there for a long time. And then in 2000, 2001, we were bought by American Public Media, who moved us into new studios in downtown LA. But that's where the money was. But it's also, or was also, intentional, because being not in New York and not in D.C. lets us talk about what happens in those two places, what happens in the markets, what happens in the regulatory environment, what happens in policy and legislation, without being of those places. And that, to me, even though it means that we have to start our days really early, that, to me, I think, gives us the ability to look at a story and say, not really, no. It's not either our story, it's not a story that the rest of the country cares about. It's really inside baseball, inside Washington, inside Wall Street, and we're going to walk on by, because that's not our brief, that's not our mandate.
And so given that, I know people want to know what your work day is like, but what is the flow, what is the schedule on which Marketplace gets produced, given that
right.
West Coast position, and how your day goes, how it all comes together?
So my day goes like this. I get up really early because I like to run in the mornings, but I get up early, I read into the news for about an hour, hour and 15 minutes, I go for a run for an hour, come back, shower, shave, and I'm out the door at 6:45 every morning. Our editorial meeting starts at 7:30 with the core group in LA, and then we've got reporters and editors on the line from Washington and New York. We've got our partners, the BBC, on the line from London. And we hash out how we're going to fill the news hole, right? Marketplace is, by the clock, 28 minutes and 45 seconds. Not 28:46, not 28:44, but 28:45. Some portion of that is taken up with underwriting credits and music and the numbers and a cutaway and all that stuff. So the editorial content hole on any given day is about 22 plus or minus minutes. We have some portion of that in the can with pre-taped interviews, pre-taped feature stories, stuff we know is going to happen. And that leaves us a news hole every day of 6, 8, 10, sometimes 12 or 14 minutes that we have to fill from that morning meeting. So we're in the meeting for half an hour, plus or minus, maybe 8:15 if it's a really slow day in August and we're killing ourselves trying to find a story. Although this August was pretty eventful, as we all know. excuse me. At 8:15, we break up. The editors go assign their reporters. Those reporters then have 4.5 hours to take what are often complicated and really complex news of the day, business and economic stories, and translate them into something that is listenable. I do interview prep. I actually do interviews. I somehow managed to fill four and a half hours of my day somehow. And then about 12:30 or so, excuse me, I'm getting over the disease that has been going through my house. About 12:30, I sit down and write the show. We go on the air at 2 o'clock L.A. time. We're live in L.A. at 2 o'clock on KCRW. Some stations on the East Coast take us live. But I sit down at 12:30 and I start to think about how I want the show to flow, knowing what's in the show, knowing what the news of the day is, what the lead story is, and what else is there. And I start to write the show from the bottom up. I always start with the last item in the show. I write the introduction to that, the setup to that. I work my way up toward the top of the broadcast. And then by 10 minutes to 2, plus or minus, I'm writing the open, the bit you hear right after the gong, and then the top of the newscast, which is arguably the most important part of the show, because that's the part that grabs you guys and makes you want to stick around. Right, and my job is to make you guys stick around from the gong to that last bit where I say, all right, that's all we got, I gotta go. Hopefully it's all written by then, because the show starts at 2 whether I'm ready or not, as I often joke. At 2:05, I go brush my teeth, because I like to be minty fresh. I don't know how it started, but I've been doing it this way for 14 years. And then at 2 we go on the air. And hopefully it all comes together. Fingers crossed.
And I don't know whether you've acknowledged this before, but I'm sure you have. But I've been listening to Marketplace for a long, long time, like everyone here. And there's a sound.
Oh yeah.
To Marketplace, and it isn't that the voice, because you have a distinctive voice, and so did David Brancaccio in the chair before you, and so did Tess Viglin on the weekends. but you all talk alike when you're on Marketplace, or at least that's the impression we have. The delivery is...
So here's what happens. When I first got the job on the afternoon show, people would say to me, you sound exactly like David Brancaccio. And I'm like, no, I really don't. What happens is you are hearing the sound of the show. And if you take a piece of tape of David Brancaccio and David Brown, who was the host for a couple of years before I got this job, and me, and you play us back to back to back, you will hear that we sound different. What you hear, excuse me, what you hear is the sound of the program. It is the thing that is our identity. We call it, as you saw in that video, marketplaciness. It is that thing that we have that makes people want to pay attention to us. It is, I don't believe, actually, that it can be taught. I think you got it or you don't. And you can bring it or you can't. And you can make people want to pay attention to a business and economic story because of the way you deliver it. Not necessarily just the voicing, but the tape that you choose, the way you write it, how you talk about the subject at hand. It is our value add. It's the thing that we bring to the table that makes people go, oh yeah, Marketplace. Now I understand why I need to know about auction rate securities to just pick something completely obtuse, right? We did a lot of stories on auction rate securities in the middle of the financial crisis. And oh my goodness, auction rate securities, right? But they matter, and we have the ability to tell you why they matter and make you care about it, which is honestly a remarkable thing. That make you care about a thing.
And so there's really no training for it. There are pauses at certain places. There's a certain kind of clipped delivery, I think.
Well, so that's me, right? And as you listen to me now, I don't sound now the way I sound on the air, right? I am syncopated on the air. I don't know why that happens. I don't know how it happens. I have a rule, and this is true, that if you think about how you sound on the radio while you are on the radio, you will inevitably screw up how you sound on the radio. You just will. A lot of times when I sit down to do an interview over the ISDN, you know, the fancy phone line that we have that makes you sound like you're in the same room, and somebody's in a New York studio or in Boston or whatever, and they're nervous because they've never been on the radio before, or they're big fans of the show, and oh my goodness, I'm on the air, and you know, whatever. I often tell them not to think, just talk. And it's the God's honest truth. I don't and can't think about how I sound when I'm on the radio, because it will wreck it. And you can hear it when I do. When I start thinking, you can actually hear it, which is sort of a self-pejorative thing to say, but it's true.
And what's interesting is I wanted to ask you about the access that you've gotten to interview the president, which obviously not most journalists don't get, and certainly in a one-on-one, and certainly three times. But what I found interesting, and I've listened to all of those interviews, is that you and the president have similar ways of talking in a syncopated way. And so listening to you talk, you know, with these pauses is really quite interesting.
Really
is have you gotten that access because he's a listener? I mean, I just suspect he is a listener to the show.
So I'll tell you a quick story. I think we got the access because... The first time, anyway, they called us, and it's true, by the way, what you saw in the video. I actually, so we got 42 minutes left. I'll tell a very quick story. 3 years ago, I'm sitting in my office at 7:20 in the morning, and adjacent to my office is the big conference room that we use. It's called the War Room. And the guy who was then producing the morning show, his name is Rod Abid, sort of wandered out into the conference room and said aloud to nobody in particular, but vaguely toward me, the White House called, and they want to know if we want to talk to the president. And I thought that what they meant was that they were offering us a slot. You know how he does when he's got a message he wants to get out? He goes to some remote TV studio, and they put a thing in his ear, and he talks to local news anchors in Sheboygan and Omaha and Wichita and wherever for like 2 minutes at a pop, right? And I thought that's what they were offering us. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. We've got 12 million people who listen to this radio broadcast. I want the whole smash. And I said, no, I'm not doing it. Thankfully, Sitara Nieves, my producer, and Deborah Clark, who's sitting right over there, the executive producer and vice president of the Marketplace, said, basically, shut up. And they got back on the phone with the White House. And the White House said, listen, the president is talking in Nevada on Thursday. If you can be there by 1 o'clock, you get 15 minutes of his time. And they said, yes, of course, we'll do that. They called us, I think, that first time because they know that we can translate esoteric, boring, complicated topics in a way that people will understand. And they didn't want the CNBC interview. They didn't want the Wall Street Journal thing. They wanted to speak regular English to people. And what happened, okay, so this story's about to get a little bit longer. So they said, if you can be in Vegas, if you can be in Nevada by 1 o'clock, you can have 15 minutes of the president's time. So that morning, Deb and myself and our engineer, Jeff Peters, we go to Burbank Airport, we get on a Southwest plane, and we go to Las Vegas. We land in Las Vegas, we rent a car, and we drive probably 25 miles out into the desert where the president is making an energy policy speech at a solar facility plant, right? Solar arrays for acres and acres and acres and acres and acres. So we get there. The president's not there yet. The crowd has gathered. And then all of a sudden, the Secret Service basically says, nobody can move. Stay where you are. And we had told the White House advance people, listen, we need to, in order to get the sound back to LA the same day, we had to set up a satellite thing and do this and that. We need 10 minutes in the physical location where we're going to do this interview before the president gets there so that we can be ready to go and get the sound back. Because if we don't get the sound back, what's the point of having this interview? And they said, we'll do what we can. Secret Service comes, locks us down. President does his speech. He's yabbering, right? I mean, I say that not pejoratively, but wah, right? An energy policy speech. And the whole time, Deb and I are like, all right, we got to go. Because the place where we were going to do the interview was out behind some equipment shed, literally in the middle of this solar field. Because the White House staff didn't want the national traveling press with the president to know that they were giving an exclusive interview to Marketplace. So they had us, it wasn't quite an outhouse, but it was like an equipment shed. So they had us, they said, listen, you're going to be way over there. And it was like 200 yards away. President stops talking. He starts working the rope line, and the advance team goes, okay, go. And so we're trudging through, and it's, you know, it's like, what, April in Nevada, and it's 1,000 degrees, and there's solar reflecting, and it's just, it's miserable. So we're trudging along. We get to where we're going to be. Jeff Peters, our engineer, starts setting up the gear, and it was literally three folding chairs in the middle of the desert, one for the president, one for me, and one for the gear, right? So Jeff Peters, who was a lovely man but not the best under deadline pressure, starts setting up the gear, right? And he's doing this and this, and knowing that he had probably less than 10 minutes. Jeff gets 2 minutes into a setup, and I hear coming around the corner of his motorcade, I hear Obama say, all right, who do we got here? And what you have to understand is that for the 36 hours preceding this, right, from the time the White House called, everybody and their grandma had been saying to me, you need to ask him this, talk about this, what about this, you have to do this, how could you not do this? And I'm a reasonably bright guy, but there's a finite amount of information that I can cram into my head. And so what happens is that the pressure increases, you're standing there waiting for the president, you're like, oh my God, what am I going to do? It's the president of the United States, first time down the street for me. He comes around the corner of his limousine, I stand up to greet him. And in that moment where we met at the bumper of his Chevy Suburban, the big black one, I had a moment of clarity. I had it, all the pressure just went and went away. And I knew it was going to be okay. And I introduced myself. Mr. President, it's good to see you. He had been really well briefed. He knew about my military background. He knew about my service in the Foreign Service. I had even prepared like a little icebreaker joke. She's an eight now. Back then she was five-ish, 4 3/4. And she had pajamas, Stars and Stripes pajamas, shorts and a pajama top that were the flag. And she called them her Obama-jamas. And so I said to the president, I figured I would use my line, right, because I had thought about it. And I said, Mr. President, I got to tell you, on behalf of my daughter, and I told him the Obama-jama line. And he was like, Obama-jamas, I love that. And then I said, Mr. President, I'm really sorry, but we're not ready yet. We need to just kill like 8 minutes. And he said, all right, let's sit down. Take your jacket off. Let's talk. And so I shot the breeze with the President of the United States for 5 or 8 minutes while Jeff Peters was working frantically on the stuff. But to answer the question, in the course of that 8 or 10 minute conversation, we actually have this on tape because Jeff had the tape recorder set up even though he didn't have the satellite stuff set up. We have him saying, oh yeah, Marketplace. I used to listen to Marketplace all the time when they let me drive. Now I'm not allowed to drive anymore. So that's the first interview with the president. I think they called the second and third time, honestly, because now they know us. They know me. They know what kind of interview we're going to do, and they know how it's going to go. And, you know, hopefully they call again before he leaves.
And you ask tough questions. I actually watched a video of you interviewing the president, and one of the things I noticed, and he didn't react to this, is you went like this. Pointed, for those on the radio, you pointed in the president's face and said, you mean that blah, 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 and you kept your finger pointed at him while he was answering.
So,
but I think they will still call again.
For the radio audience, you can't see this, but I'm a demonstrative person and I speak with my hands. But here's the thing about the president and about doing an interview with him. Two things about it. First of all, the first time I talked to him, and I imagine the first time anybody talks to him, you game it out to the nth degree. You know you've got 15 minutes and you're like, all right, question one will be this, question two will be this, question three will be this, question four will be this. Because, you know, you figure 2 minutes an answer, you get 7 questions, and boom, you're done. And if you waste a question, then there's 2 minutes that just vaporizes and you don't have it anymore, you know? And in that first interview, actually, in the desert on the folding chairs, I actually asked a follow-up that we hadn't really considered beforehand, and we wound up cutting it because it was a useless answer. And I wasted 3 minutes of the president's time. The more you talk to him, the more you realize that what you have to do is you have to go with your gut. And your program may be the first question, and then you wing it from there because you have to react to what he says, which gets you to the second and third interviews. And the second item about interviewing the president, when you interview him, if you interrupt him or cut him off or speak over him, a really interesting thing happens. So you're in the Oval Office. It's me and Obama in the chairs that you see in front of the fireplace all the time, right? He's over here, I'm over here, and then there are those two couches. My engineer is in one seat, my producer's in another seat, and then the rest of them are all filled with White House staffers, right? Communications people and you know, all kinds of, like, staffers for him. If you interrupt him, the whole room gets really tense. He gets tense, the advisors get tense, and nobody likes it when you interrupt the man. It's the most interesting thing. But you kind of have to because, come on, right? I mean, you can't just say, here's my microphone, take my entire airtime and go. That doesn't make any sense.
All right, especially when you have that one-on-one opportunity.
Right.
We're going to get to some questions from our audience here, but before that, I just want to remind everyone that this is the Commonwealth Club of California program. We're talking to Kai Ryssdal, host of American Public Media's Marketplace. I'm John Boland, your moderator. You can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. One of the other things I wanted to ask, you talked about the Marketplace team with you out in the desert. How big is the team?
Not big enough. Seriously, I mean, if you think
about what
we do.
There's never enough money in public radio.
If you think about what we do, we are amazingly lean. Our editorial staff is plus or minus 50 people. It's a bureau in New York, a bureau in Washington. We've got Stephen Beard sort of on retainer in London now. He is semi-retired but still files for us because he can't help himself. Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. And then the core team in L.A. It's plus or minus 50.
So this is a guidance for an aspiring journalist out there somewhere. Any advice for a fellow news junkie with no journalism experience who is interested in public radio?
Call Cyrus Musiker.
Yes.
tell him I sent you. So here's the deal. I didn't actually learn this until a couple of weeks into my stint at KQED. If you are starting, And this goes for any field, right? But if you are starting, you can never say no. If somebody says, can you get up at 4:30 in the morning and help produce the morning news, the answer has to be yes. It has to be yes. If somebody says to you, as they did to me, listen, can you come up here on Sunday morning to San Francisco and record sound of Chinese New Year celebrations so we can use it in a newscast on Monday, the answer has to be yes. The answer has to be yes. It is, first of all, it shows the initiative and it shows the go-gettingness that you're going to have. But it also teaches you. That sound that I gathered from the Chinese New Year's parade, my first, month and a half at KQED, turned out to be completely unusable because I didn't know what I was doing. But I never made that mistake again. Never did. You got to say yes. Getting your foot in the door is another issue, but you got to say yes. I mean, I'm convinced, actually, just on the foot in the door part, if I had been a 21-year-old kid or a 24-year-old kid straight out of journalism school, and I had written to Cyrus and said, hey, I just graduated from Berkeley J School and this and that and blah, 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 Cyrus would have tossed mine on the reject heap in a heartbeat. What I had was I had something different. And the only reason I am where I am today is because I took the time early on to figure out what I didn't want to do, if that makes any sense. I had a great time in the Navy. Shaped me to this day, but it wasn't what I wanted to do forever. Same thing with the Foreign Service.
And interesting. Talk a little bit about that. Those jobs maybe gave you a sense of what you didn't want to do for the rest of your life, but how have they prepared you for what you're doing now, or how do they affect your performance?
The first answer has to be discipline, right? I mean, you can't spend 8 years in the military and not come out of it with a little discipline. I mean, I think that played to my character to begin with, but, you know, when I was 26 years old, I was in the fleet. I was a brand new lieutenant junior grade. I had 30 guys working for me, taking care of $350 million worth of airplane. And once you have that, you know what responsibility is. You know what it means to lead people. And you know what it takes to get things done. And with that comes the discipline, the responsibility, the authority that you have to have in almost anything you do.
Why don't we talk a little bit about some of the news you've been reporting on, because I think people want to hear about that, and August has been,
tell you what,
was
right?
Quite a month.
Yeah.
China, where you spent part of your career and speak the language and have reported from there for Marketplace. What's at the core of the problem, and how worried should we be? And in other words, how much does what China is going through economically now impact us?
You should be low to low medium worried. Honestly, right? I mean, the American economy is healthy, it's growing, jobs are growing, the recovery is now 6+ years old. Don't pay any attention to the stock market. Let me say that one more time. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is not the economy is not the Dow Jones Industrial Average. But here is what I believe is going on in China, and I had a conversation last night with a guy who disagreed but had other thoughts. I think what has happened is that the Chinese government has come to the point where it can no longer handle the capitalist beast that it has created, right? And now that now that there is a thick layer of rising and achieved middle-class people in China, they don't know what to do with that deal that they made 35 years ago when Deng Xiaoping said it doesn't matter if the cat is black or white as long as it catches mice, which is to say it's okay to get rich. Right? Doesn't matter what capitalism looks like, communism looks like. The deal was, we will trade you your political rights for economic opportunity. And they did that for 35 years, and it worked really well. And now, they're stuck in this place where, because of structural changes in the Chinese economy, right, dealings that they're having to make with state-owned enterprises, foreign competition, the rising cost of labor over there, which is kind of an amazing thing to say. I mean, that's the thing that we discovered when we were there 5 years, 6 years ago. They don't know what to do with that. And the symptom is the stock market, but the actual cause is much more deeper and fundamental.
There's a question from the audience. When is the financial bubble going to pop? Now, I don't know whether that's a very Bay Area question, because I think a lot of people around the country may think it has popped with the correction that we went through over the recent weeks. But do you think we're in a financial bubble or in this market in a tech bubble? And how far does that go?
I think, so first of all, and let me say this one more time, pay no attention to the stock market, right? What happened in the stock market the last month is a good thing. It is a good thing. The Dow was at 18,000 and change, and that is bananas, right? I mean, yay for 401ks and yay for retirements, but nothing goes up forever. So the idea that we are letting some steam out of a really superheated stock market is a good thing. Everybody pause, regroup, don't sell, don't do all that stuff, right? Listen to your financial advisors, and by the way, I'm not one, get independent financial advice. but don't be doing crazy things when crazy things happen in the market. Just sit tight. So I think the idea that we have a financial bubble is overwrought, right? I mean, jobless rate is 5.1%. We're adding plus or minus 200,000 jobs. We've gained back 97-ish percent of all the jobs we lost in the recession. Yes, they're different kind of jobs now and that whole conversation. But there's no economic bubble going on in this country. What y'all are doing here, I don't know, man. I don't know. I mean, and you guys are feeling it all the time, right? What does it probably take, an hour and a half to get from here to Palo Alto? I mean, crazy, right? I have to get to the airport tomorrow. How long should I leave, right? I mean, that's a real question. Yeah, leave now, right. I don't think it's a bubble like it was last time. I think the fundamentals of what is going on here are completely different. There are no pets.com out there, you know, and let's all remember that. But at the same time, I think we should just be looking at this really closely and going, okay, all right, it's good for now. It's good for now. And amazing things are happening here. I mean, amazing things. Amazing things. But nothing goes up forever.
As we have learned time and again. It's a very interesting question. What is the most heartbreaking story you've ever reported on Marketplace? The question is, what story broke your heart?
So we have reported from China in substance twice. We have a bureau chief there in Shanghai. His name is Rob Schmitz. He's really good. He's been in China off and on for 20 years, and he knows great stuff. But we did the shows from China, as you saw in that video, in January 2006. We did Shanghai for a week and Chongqing out in Western Sichuan Province for a week. 5 years ago, we took a small team back to do a follow-up to revisit some of the issues that we had covered the first time. And we went to I forget what it was. Now I'm going to ask Deb Clark, my boss and my producer on that trip. Remember that the woman working in the cardboard fabrication place run by the American who moved and hadn't seen her kid? And yeah, so we went to this, and I forget what it was. It was run by an American, and they were making like shipping containers or small prefab cardboard somethings. Anyway, manufacturing operation just outside of Shanghai, probably 15 or 20 people there, all of them migrant workers, and the woman we latched onto and spoke to, and this is repeated millions of times across that country, had left her child at home with her parents in the hinterland somewhere, come to Shanghai to get a job. The child was a baby. The child was probably one or two. Her husband was working somewhere else, and she had left to go pursue this thing that is happening in the cities there, which is economic growth, right? All the growth is in the cities. And she hadn't seen her child for whatever. Now that's an easy and a facile example, but when you multiply that by the millions of people it is happening to as the second biggest economy in the world undergoes this structural transformation, it is a heartbreaking story. Maybe not the most, but it is certainly something that pulled at me for a while. Yeah.
You also reported from Greece not too long ago.
Oh, yeah.
Talk a little bit about that and the situation in Europe, because you gave us a good rundown on the situation here.
So when we went to Greece a month and a half ago, I expressly didn't want to talk to academics. I didn't want to talk to analysts. I didn't want to talk to corporate people. I wanted to talk to the people in the Greek economy who were living with 25% unemployment, 50% for 23 to 30-year-olds. Half of the young people in that country are unemployed. They have virtually no control over their economic future, and I wanted to know what was going on. And so we literally walked the streets for 4 days with a microphone out, talking to people, shop owners, passersby, people who our fixers, our translators there had found. And a couple of things became clear, just in the sense of Greece, and then I'll draw it out to the larger conclusion. First of all, they are absolutely, completely out of luck for the foreseeable future. I would use a stronger language, but this is going to go on the radio. Virtually all the people we talked to had children, and ranging in age from little babies to teenagers. And to a person, they said, this isn't going to be fixed for me. I will not know economic security in my lifetime. I'm just hoping that it can be better for my kids in a generation, which is unfathomable, really. The idea that you've given up. And, you know, we talked to a woman who had a PhD in comparative law. She was a fellow at the Hellenic Law Institute before everything went to heck. And she's working 3 hours a day in a tourist dress shop, right? Probably making, I don't know, in the tens of euros a day, if that. But they all of them, and we've checked in with a couple of them since we came back, they all have said, listen, I really hope that you can come back when we can show you Greece as it is meant to be, when we can show you this country as we know it to be. Now, they've got some really serious problems, right? Chronic tax evasion and public pensions and all of that stuff. But they believe that they can be better, but it's not going to be anytime soon. The larger thing in Europe, and I saw something on Twitter the other day which really struck me. A guy by the name of Christopher Hayes, who hosts a program on MSNBC, he said the migrant crisis in Europe and the Greek debt crisis are at the root the same problem. And what he meant was they are both, what is happening with those crises now are manifestations of the European Union, which is, let us remember, the single biggest trading partner this country has. 450 million people over there, tens of trillions of dollars worth of goods and services go back and forth every year. That economic union is unable to function. It is unable to make the critically difficult decisions it needs, whether it's human decisions in the migrant crisis or economic decisions in the Greek debt crisis. And if they don't figure that out, you know, the euro's going to last for a while. Nobody's going to join the euro now for a while, right? No country's going to do that. But if they can't figure it out, then what happens? We should be thinking about that. Excuse me.
What is it about the on-location reporting? I mean, for you personally, because obviously you could have a reporter there and you could do a two-way on the air. Why do you, what makes the difference about you going to Greece or to China?
So a couple of things. Me going, me as the face and the voice of the broadcast, indicates to our listeners the importance with which we take the story, the importance with which I believe in the story's relevance to our audience. So that's issue number one. Issue number two, and a little bit more superficial really, but it's true, is that I spend a disproportionate amount of my time in a very small, soundproof room with all alone with a microphone. And sometimes you just go a little bonkers and you want to get out of there and you want to know what people think. So that's one way I do it, right? I get out and I do reportage. The other way I do it is honestly events like these, to know what is on your minds through these questions, through the conversations that I'm sure many of you will have with me after this is over. These events and others get me out and let me know what is on your minds, because journalism in all times, but especially today, cannot be a one-way enterprise. It doesn't work anymore if I'm just telling you what we in our 7:30 meeting decide that you need to know, right? That doesn't work. So we need to know what you want to know, and then we can make those calculations as we plan our coverage.
So this is kind of a Kai Ryssdal sort of question. One of the things that I've learned over the years of working with people like yourself who are really stars in journalism, who really are the face and the voice of a program. And I think Marketplace is more successful than ever in your 10 years. I've always found that people who are very popular draw a large audience, lots of people like them. Yeah. There's also always a group of people who don't like them as much as the other people like them.
And see my Twitter feed.
And so I looked online at comments about you.
Oh, yay, let's read some of those. Okay.
And actually, I think it may not be so bad. So the Merriam-Webster definition of snarky is sarcastic, impertinent, or irreverent. What say you? Are you snarky? I mean, because that's the comment that comes up most often. I know you know that.
I am irreverent, but I'm irreverent with a purpose. I am irreverent to the stock answer, to the pat response, to the spin. Oftentimes, the best question I ask in an interview, usually with a politician, sometimes with a CEO, is after they've said whatever they're going to say and after however they've spun whatever they're going to spin, oftentimes the best question is simply to take about a half a beat and look at them and say, come on, really? Now, if that's irreverent, so be it. I'll take that one. What I don't want to be characterized as, and we work really hard at this actually, is being glib. Because first of all, that's rude. And second of all, it demeans what we try to do, which is try to make this stuff understandable in a way that you all as listeners know why it matters. And if our glibness gets in the way of that, then we're just wasting our time.
Good answer. And actually, when I looked up snarky, because I kept seeing snarky, and I thought, well, what does that really mean? Irreverent.
Right.
I think journalists should be irreverent. Mm-hmm. We thought we would try something interesting, a lightning round. And I'm
all
just
right.
going to...
I'm ready.
I'm just going to throw words at you.
Okay.
And then you're just going to...
You want my gut response?
And you're just going to have your gut response. Right. What does it mean? What do you think? What's important about it? Income inequality.
The single biggest issue in this coming election, it is the biggest problem in the American economy today, full stop.
Too big to fail.
Still too big to fail. The biggest banks are still big. We have not, in my considered opinion, adequately dealt with some of the issues that caused the financial crisis, and are still learning the lessons of the crisis regarding too big to fail.
Flat tax or progressive tax?
Wow, really? So I will go to my rule, which is to dodge. No, I'm kidding. Here's why I'm saying that. Here's why I'm saying that. It is, and this is a much more fundamental issue about journalism and what I believe my place in it is. I thought for a long time that it was not necessarily my job to not have an opinion, but to not let you, the listener, know what that opinion is. I don't actually believe that anymore, because sometimes my opinions are actually objective fact. And that sounds like I'm being all full of myself, right? But sometimes your opinions are objective fact, and your opinions are fact. That's just kind of the way it works. And I think we, as responsible journalists in a representative democracy, have to be unafraid to say, this is a fact. And we shy away from it because we're afraid of being attacked from the other side, right? We're afraid of being accused of being liberal or conservative or what have you, right? And that is why I'm going to dodge that question, because that one is loaded and puts me on the spot.
Made in America, made in China.
You know, here's the deal. I think if you look at what happens with a lot of manufactured goods in this economy, there is value proposition on both sides. The bigger question really is, how do American corporations establish the worth of the worker in this economy and society, in the economic ecosystem that we live in, where we can have things made overseas for a dime on the dollar, but it costs good, solid American jobs. While at the same time, we can make slightly less money for shareholders, and I understand the concept of fiduciary responsibility, believe you me, but can we take slightly less profit for shareholders and put it toward the value of work in this economy?
IPOs.
Oh, that's funny. I thought you said IPAs. Yes, for IPAs.
Later.
IPOs are an interesting beast. I talk to entrepreneurs. I talk to pre-IPO CEOs and post-IPO CEOs. And there are goods and bads with both, right? If you want access to the capital markets, you have to be willing to do that. But with that comes a whole raft of responsibilities and, more importantly, annoyances, right? You will not find a CEO out there who enjoys the quarterly conference calls that they have with analysts on earnings day. Not on one of them. I'm sure they'd all rather have unanesthetized root canal, honestly, right? But if you want to be in the big markets, you have to take those responsibilities. So IPOs are good, capital markets are good, but you got to play by those rules, and that sometimes can be a tricky beast.
21st century immigration and really economic impact. A lot going on globally.
There is a lot going on globally. I think that, so the lightning round answer is this. We simply must find, as an economy and as a body politic, a way to deal with migration in this country. It is less, there are fewer migrants now, illegal migrants in this country, undocumented migrants in this economy, than there were before the financial crisis. But we have to, both morally and economically, figure out a way to incorporate them, because it's not like they're going away. You can Donald Trump me till the cows come home, but the idea that we're going to round up 11.1 million people and figure out a way to not have them be here anymore is specious.
Speaking of which, Donald Trump.
Oh, my God, is he in? but wait. So I mean, how entertaining is the guy, right? I have no idea what's going to happen in November of 2016. I honestly don't. But you can't not watch. You can't. I mean, honestly, it's the most remarkable thing. What else is there to say, right?
The British pound.
What's
going on with
the British pound? What is going on with the British pound? I don't know. I mean, it's quaint that they want to hang on to their own currency. I bet they're really glad now that they hung on to their own currency. What I think is really interesting, though, just to sort of take a tangential response to this, is the promise that David Cameron has made to the British people that he's going to have a vote on whether or not to stay in the European Union. He's going to have a referendum on that. And what the Brits decide, my guess is they're going to stay, but don't quote me on that. I'll deny it if you repeat it. I get it. It's too late for that. It's interesting that he is doing that in a move toward direct democracy on something as fundamental as that.
Similarly on currency, is the U.S. dollar still the gold standard?
There's like 14 layers in that question. Dollar, gold standard. We are and will be, for the foreseeable future, the reserve currency, simply because we are the biggest and most powerful economy on the planet, and the dollar is the tradable currency. It's this thing that everybody wants. Even with interest rates low here, people are still piling into American bond markets. That's just kind of the way it works. Now, what that's going to be in 20 years, I have no idea. But I'll tell you what is actually true. That time horizon has been pushed back. The Chinese, with the devaluation of the renminbi, the yuan, what, 6 weeks ago now? I mean, a month maybe. Sort of showed that they weren't ready to play in the global currency game. Because nobody's going to take the yuan as a reserve currency when it's not freely traded and when the government does things because it feels like it. I mean, that's not a productive economic proposition.
Let's do two more of these. Dodd-Frank.
I had a thing that I said during the early days of the recovery of the financial crisis, and I said, you know what? This has been a crisis wasted. And what I meant was that we didn't, in the early days, do enough to make sure that what had happened to us as an economy would never happen again, because it was a traumatic experience, right? It wasn't the Great Depression, but it was pretty darn close. I think, by and large, Dodd-Frank is a positive. I think there is more that could be done to ensure financial stability. But I think on net, we're not done with fixing what happened so that it doesn't ever happen again.
And Occupy Wall Street.
This goes back to the first question, income inequality. And what's really amazing about Occupy Wall Street and the 99% is how, when was that, 2011, right, plus or minus, is how that has just disappeared from the conversation. Disappeared from the conversation. You will hear on Marketplace a lot of discussion of income inequality as a factor in this election in the next year. We are not going to do horse race stuff. We're not going to do who's winning by how much. We're not going to do all the political baloney that you will hear elsewhere in public media and on cable news. That's not our brief. Our brief is and will be forever in politics the economic issues at hand. And as I said when we started the lightning round, income inequality is the single biggest issue in this economy. 99% is a manifestation of that, and it will come up again in 2016 as it progresses.
I'm going to ask a couple questions from the audience about Marketplace and how the show is put together. One of them is about storytelling and the approach, the style of Marketplace to storytelling and how important that is to the success of the program.
Storytelling is everything, right? It's everything in our medium, which is audio, and you see that in the rise of podcasts, right? Serial and Invisibilia and all that stuff. But it is also elemental in the kind of reporting that we do, because we must, if we're going to get you to pay attention, we have to find the stories that will resonate. I don't know how many of you saw, or rather heard, our series that our Wealth and Poverty team did last year called York and Fig, where they went to an area of Los Angeles called Highland Park, which is rapidly gentrifying. They, rented a storefront. They rented a storefront for 3 months and produced exquisite journalism, which was people-based, had clear understandings of the economic repercussions of what was happening in those stories, and told stories in a way that made you pay attention. Chrissy Clark, who's the senior reporter on our Wealth and Poverty Desk, did two pieces to round it out at the end of the week, Thursday, Friday. We ran York and Fig over a week. And remember I said Marketplace, our news hole is 22 minutes every single day. 20 to 22 minutes. We ran her Thursday story at 9 minutes, so almost half of our entire news budget for the day, and her Friday story at 11 minutes, more than half of our content, because it was such an important piece of storytelling. It's vital to what we do.
So we've reached the point in our program where there's time for just one last question. And this question is from the audience, and it's really, I think, I'd interpret it to what's the magic of such a successful program, and why does Marketplace and how does Marketplace make subjects like economics and business approachable in a way where a lot of other programs don't?
We don't fundamentally care about business and economics. We really don't. There are no PhDs in economics on our staff. There are no MBAs. There are no people with trading licenses. What we do at Marketplace is we take stories, we use the lens of business economics to tell them in a way that makes you, the listener, want to hear these things that, even though you may not know it at the time, matter so deeply to all of our lives. If we learned one thing from the financial crisis, it's that if we don't understand what happens inside that black box that we call Wall Street and high finance, and inside that 17 point whatever it is trillion dollar behemoth that is the American economy, if we don't know what's going on, then we all lose. So what we do is we take the stories, we take people, and we put them in this lens of business and the economy, and we put it on the radio.
Perfect answer. Our thanks to Kai Ryssdal, host of American Public Media's Marketplace. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm John Boland, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Boom. There you go, John. Cool.